Hello and welcome to Shoot the Hostage with me, Dan, and my partner, Sarah. We're a movie podcast who talks about a different film each week based on a theme. We do swear and we do spoil the featured movie, so only ever listen if you've seen the film or you don't care too much about spoilers. If you're a regular listener, you can just skip forward until you hear the intro music because you've heard all of this before. But if you are new to the show and you do enjoy what you hear, there are a couple of things you can do to help support the show. Firstly, make sure that you're subscribed on your podcast player so you get notified when new shows drop on Mondays. You could rate us 5 stars on Spotify, which couldn't be easier. You just hit the star icon below the show's artwork. Or if you have a spare few minutes, we'd love it if you could submit a review wherever you listen. Make sure you come follow us at STH_pod on social media. We are active on Instagram, X, Threads, and TikTok. And lastly, the biggest thing you can do to help is tell a friend about the show. So that's about it. That's enough preamble from me. Over to me and Sarah for this week's episode. Okay, we're continuing our neo-western theme for the second episode in the season, and it's our second episode about a movie what has got Jeremy Renner in it.
This season?
Not this season. It's our second episode of the season, you understand.
Yeah, I know how numbers work.
we once covered a film that had Jeremy Renner in it in season
did
3.
We?
Yeah, Arrival.
Oh, shit. Yeah, of course we did.
This came out in 2017. Arrival came out in 2016. So okay. It's the second film in as many years that Jeremy Renner has played a parent with a dead kid.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
It's also the second Taylor Sheridan movie that we've covered. Yes. Do remember that.
Yeah, we covered Hell or High Water in season 2.
Yeah, such a good film.
Yeah. This is his last movie in what he calls a Frontier Trilogy. Hell or High Water is the second. The first one was Sicario. Wind River, though, it had a budget of $11 million and a box office of $45 million.
Is that all? I don't know why I'm surprised.
No, I think that's... You know, pretty that's, good.
Yeah, standard budget. For something that's not a blockbuster,
yeah.
I guess.
But it did really well initially. It had a limited opening weekend, but it made $161,000 from 4 theatres, which is an average of $40,000 per screen. And it ended up getting a much wider release and then making the full $45 million.
Based on how well it did in the 4 screens?
I guess so. It had a sort of a limited release and they thought, oh, this is doing quite well. Let's give it a wider release.
Oh, good.
It's got an average rating on Letterboxd of 3.8 and an average rating on IMDb of 7.7. I've got a synopsis here. You ready for that?
Sure.
Nothing is harder to track than the truth. An FBI agent teams up with the town's veteran game tracker to investigate a murder that occurred on a Native American reservation. It was written and directed by Taylor Sheridan, as we said, who wrote Sicario, Hell or High Water, and was in Sons of Anarchy.
Yeah.
Was an actor.
He was an actor, yes.
So you probably know him mostly from... Well, no, not mostly, but you probably saw him first from...
Yeah.
In Sons of Anarchy, right? Did he play a policeman?
Yes, or some sort of sheriff.
Mm.
And I didn't know who the fuck he was, didn't know what his name was. And it wasn't until I think I saw Hell or High Water, did a bit of digging and recognised his face and put 2 and 2 together. So I didn't know he was quite a talented screenwriter and filmmaker.
Yeah, okay. He's quite popular now as well for Yellowstone, I think. And Yellowstone, we're going back in time.
Is that the Kevin Costner thing?
Yes.
Okay.
I think there's a few spin-offs as well, which people tend to enjoy. I don't think it looks like it's for me particularly. I have seen clips of Kevin Costner like going on a tirade against a vegan because a vegan eats more animals apparently than someone that's not a vegan.
Wait, what? In the show or in real life?
In the show.
Okay.
But I think Sheridan maybe has lent his viewpoints on that. If he's incorporated his own views within that kind of screenplay, I think.
So, is he anti-vegan?
He seems to be. Yeah, he did Joe Rogan a little while ago, and I watched that.
And say no more.
it's I mean, you know, it's that. He writes good movies. He makes good movies. He's grossly misinformed on the vegan thing, and it's quite laughable. But you know, you've got to kind of set that aside, I guess.
Do you know what I think is hilarious? And I'm not getting into like any sort of vegan politics right now. Don't worry before you instantly switch off. It's not going down that road.
I'll go down that road. But
I do find it funny that we have this sort of reputation for being militant and gobby about our diets, but I never hear vegans talking about what they eat and how everybody should follow suit. But I hear a lot from meat eaters saying how shit vegans are and how obnoxious we are. It's funny.
Yeah, I mean, it's you hear the sort of same arguments over and over again.
Yeah.
And they're quite easily sort of debunked. And I just don't understand why you would continue to spout something. I do understand it because you want to sort of back up what you think. But, you know, like you said, let's not get into it. But I will say that Joe Carbstrong did a really good video debunking everything that Joe Rogan and Taylor Sheridan said in that interview. So, well, yeah, if you are a vegan and you like all that, even if you're not, check out that video and find out why Taylor Sheridan is wrong.
Interesting.
But okay. Write about the movies that he writes. Let's
concentrate on the positive.
Let's concentrate on the positive, yeah. So DOP, Ben Richardson, Mayor of Easttown, 1922, which keeps popping up.
Oh, is that 1922?
That is 1922, yeah. But,
is that the Stephen King thing that we talked about? The Thomas Jane movie?
It's the Thomas Jane stands in some tall grass.
Some grass, yeah.
That's right. Yes, that one. Edited by Gary Roach, who's a bit of a Clint Eastwood person, apparently. Just like worked on Gran Torino and American Sniper. J. Edgar Invictus Changeling, and apparently Sheridan sort of poached him a bit. So
okay.
Prisoners as well, which is one that we enjoyed. It comes up a lot. Music by Nick Cave, scored by Nick Cave in this one. Same as Hell or High Water.
Yeah, I was going to say that's his name cropped up in that show as well.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I quite enjoyed the score in this one.
Yeah, it's really good.
Interesting.
Jeremy Renner as Corey Lambert, obviously Arrival, which we mentioned earlier. Hurt Locker, Mission Impossible.
Hurt Locker might be his best role. Or, well, my favourite of his roles, because I don't love him as an actor.
No.
Or a human being, in fact. I definitely don't love him as a musician.
I don't think I've heard any of his music, but...
You'd have forgotten it instantly if you had.
Okay. I think Hurt Locker probably is my favourite Jeremy Renner performance, for sure. Mm. I think he's very good in this. This might be maybe his number two. But yeah. he has a kind of a like a type, like there's a certain type of character that he plays very well, I think. But when he goes outside of that, I don't think he's so great at the kind of the quippy franchise stuff.
Okay. So you don't like him as Hawkeye, is what you're saying?
I think he's fine.
Oh, glowing praise.
Yeah, I think he's fine. I don't think he's memorable. Obviously, you've got other people that really overshadow him in that movie.
Yeah.
And I thought that the series was all right, but yeah, it just feels a little bit like bare minimum sometimes. But,
yeah.
But this movie is great. Elizabeth Olsen.
Something I want to talk about before we delve too far into it is this is the second time I've seen Wind River. And the first time I remember sort of taking issue with the fact that her character was like, she looks so young. And I know that she's supposed to be a bit wet behind the ears, you know, that's part of the story, is that she's inexperienced and out of her depth. But I found it really hard to get past. Didn't bother me the second time. I don't know why that is.
All right. Well, maybe we'll explore that then.
But she's good.
She had two movies out in 2017. Can you name the other one?
No.
Ingrid Goes West.
Oh, I love that movie.
Yeah. That's what I thought you might get. Yeah. That, actually. Yeah. Gil Birmingham plays Martin Hansen. Also, this is our second Gil Birmingham movie.
Yeah.
Hell or High Water. He had three movies out in 2017.
Oh, what else?
The Space Between Us.
I haven't seen that.
Me neither. And Transformers The Last Knight.
Oh.
And I haven't seen that, I don't think.
Oh, Gil.
Well, listen, he got paid for it.
Well, yeah.
I hope he got paid well. Graham Greene as Ben, and he's one of those. Oh, that guy.
Graham Greene,
that guy. He's in Die Hard with a Vengeance. I remember that. And Atlantic Rim, of course.
Oh, that gem that definitely wasn't ripped off of something far more successful.
Both got the word rim in it. Both good movies. John Bernthal as Matt and Kelsey as Bill as Natalie. And I think that's the main the main players.
So three MCU actors.
Yes. I suppose so. It was financed by Acacia Entertainment, a company owned by the Tanica Biloxi tribe of Louisiana.
Oh, cool.
And you might have also noticed on the credits that, unfortunately, the Weinsteins.
I did, sadly.
Were credited. Now, they did get involved to do the distribution for the film.
Mm-hmm.
And it was out in 2017, so we'll come back to that in a minute.
Okay.
Elizabeth Olsen was the first cast in the picture. I'd assumed it had been Jeremy Renner, but
yeah,
it was actually...
Well, so interestingly, I did read somewhere that Jeremy Renner was not first choice.
He was first choice.
Oh, okay.
But he was doing a rival. This is what I heard from Taylor Sheridan.
Oh, we've read conflicting things.
Oh, okay. I heard that he was first choice, but he was doing a rival.
Okay.
But as the time went on, a rival finished and then he became available. But between those two things, he was considering Chris Pine. Chris Pine. Prime Directives. something. Star Trek joke.
Chris Pine.
You heard Chris Pine, did you?
I heard that he was first choice, yeah.
Right, okay.
And then there were scheduling conflicts and Renner came on after that.
Maybe Chris Pine was first choice, but when Jeremy Renner came on board, he just went, I wanted you before I wanted Pine, don't worry. That's probably what happened.
Yeah. How do you feel about that?
About
how do you think
lying to Jeremy Renner about wanting him first?
Yeah. Do you think it's morally correct?
I don't agree with lying in general, but if it's to Jeremy Renner, I think you could lie. You could just lie and say, I've got this really good app. If you don't mind signing up for that, Jeremy Renner, you'll win a star.
Oh, cringe. No, how do you feel about the casting? Like, if it had been Chris Pine, do you think it would have been better, worse, the same?
I think...
Do you feel like you're at an eye test? Better before, now? No difference?
I think he would have been just as good, honestly. I think Renner is really good in this role. I struggle to think of many other people I would actually put in that, because as I said, I do think he's very good at delivering that kind of quiet, macho, not going to really speak my emotions, but you have to in this movie kind of deal. So I like that. And obviously Chris Pine does a similar thing in Hell or High Water as well.
Yeah.
So I think it would have been just as good. But I do prefer Pine as an actor, though.
Yeah, well, that's why I'm asking.
I feel like he's got more range, personally.
Same. And I think he's got more charisma.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I guess this role doesn't really... It's not centered or anchored by charisma. So yeah, I think you're right. I think Jeremy Renner did a really good job, which is interesting because you really didn't like him in Arrival, did you?
I just thought he was... really miscast in that one, because he has to be a scientist and just says equations at people, and I just don't buy it.
Okay.
I can't. And then that's right, he does a little kind of quippy thing in that, which kind of got on my nerves.
That was
it
was a bit jarring, wasn't it?
Yeah, it didn't fit with that movie.
Okay, but he's playing to his strengths here.
Yeah, definitely, I think so. It was shot in 2016. It began shooting in March of 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And as we mentioned earlier, the Weinsteins, they got involved in May of 2016, securing the distribution rights. The film was released in August of 2017.
Okay.
And that was just before the Weinstein scandal dropped.
Wow, okay.
Was made kind of widely known
and
reported in October of 2017. Following that report, apparently Taylor Sheridan did kind of go to town and say, we need to remove their logos from the credits, the trailer, the packaging. Weinstein Company obviously weren't too pleased about that, and they ended up pulling out of it. But I guess they still get a credit. They must have done something for that. Like, you can't remove that at all. And you can have a discussion about whether or not you should. I don't necessarily think you should go back and remove their credits from each of their movies, but
it's sort of helping to sweep it under the rug in a way. Like,
that's kind of how I feel about it, yeah.
I mean, as much as I hate... It's really curious, isn't it? As much as I hate seeing anything to do with the Weinsteins in the credits, or like, obviously I'm a big horror fan, so every time I see Dimension or Miramax, my blood starts to boil a little bit. But at the same time, if we sweep it under the rug, then we're not learning from history. That's the mistake people always make, isn't it? Like, it should be there as a reminder.
I mean, it happened. You can't...
Yeah.
He was a producer and worked on fucking hundreds of movies. Yeah, yeah, big giant piece of shit. It happened. Let's not forget about it, because as you say, you want to kind of look back on these things and go, look at that piece of shit. He got away with that for so long. Let's not do that again.
Mm.
Whereas if you sweep it under the carpet in a few generations, you might kind of forget.
Yeah.
That's kind of my thinking behind that sort of thing. And sort of the same sort of thing as you shouldn't, I don't think, necessarily change stuff from the past. And maybe things should come with like a trigger warning. But, you know,
I don't think
you should necessarily change it. It is tough, and there's probably like not a one size fits all solution. You've probably got to judge each case by its own merit.
Yeah. And to me, I think the more important thing is like, don't take their credits away. Take their money away.
Yeah.
Like, take the residuals away.
Yeah. Well, apparently Sheridan was kind of pushing for the money that they made on this to sort of go to charities, I think.
Oh, good man.
I don't know whether or not that happened.
That's a bit of a Kevin Smith move. I like it.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, he's a complicated human, Taylor Sheridan. Terrible views on veganism, but seems like he's a pretty stand-up guy.
Yeah.
And writes the shit out of a script too.
He does. I can deal with some nuance in a human. That's fine.
Exactly. I think my favourite thing about this movie is the way that it's structured and the transitions and how they affect how the story is told.
Expand on that.
So you know the scene where Jane gets pepper sprayed?
Oh, yeah.
And then Jeremy Renner goes around the back and he's picks up the shovel.
Oh, yeah,
and he shovels
yeah.
the people that are running away and he kicks someone in the face. Mm-hmm. And it then cuts to Jane's character again and she's going through the door. There's a nice cut between him cacking him in the face, between him kicking him in the face and the door opening. And that kind of that kind of trains you to accept the transition that's coming in the third act, which is the big one that goes from, we'll get to this scene, I think, probably in a bit more detail, but Jane knocks on the trailer door and then it cuts to what happened to Natalie.
Yeah.
So I feel like that was a really good way of structuring that. It kind of made it feel a bit more pacey and it built the tension for me because you see what ultimately happens to her in the opening frame.
Yeah. It's the mystery is how that happened.
Yeah, exactly. But then it gets to the kind of the third act and I feel like it utilizes that editing technique and shows that flashback in a really kind of good way, which sets up the third act nicely.
Oh,
and
I
feel
like that.
He had that transition earlier on in the film to sort of, I don't know, just sort of ease you in.
It felt, acclimatize you.
Yeah, it kind of almost felt like a Christopher Nolan trick, like in Dunkirk, he's training you how to watch the film.
Okay.
And then he does the same in, what's the other one? Oppenheimer. Yeah, that's right.
What's the other one? That little independent film.
Yeah. I was going to say Tenet, but you can't, there's no explaining Tenet. It doesn't matter how many instructions you get. It's like a Rubik's Cube. They're actually impossible. Anyone that tells you that they understand it, they're lying. So I really enjoyed how that was kind of structured and just the editing and pacing in general. There were 54 cuts made of this film and Sheridan kind of stripped it right down to the bone.
Did he? Wait, no, he didn't do the editing.
No, he didn't do the editing. He had Clint Eastwood's editor.
Yes.
But he would have been really highly involved. He definitely, you know, he wrote it, he directed it. He had all of the footage in the can that he wanted. He was very close to this project. I mean, obviously, because he's written and directed it. But I mean, this was the one that he kind of felt the most responsibility about.
Yeah, I can
see
that.
Three movies, Sicario, Hell or High Water, and this one.
Because of the film being based on true events.
I guess so. Like the real statistics that...
Well, there aren't any statistics.
Well,
that's
the
problem.
The lack thereof.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess so. And it's the story. It's not a white man's story, really. It is told from a white man's perspective. And I think probably people have got different opinions on that and why that is the way that it is.
I've been thinking about that a lot, you know.
It's something that's worth thinking about, for sure.
Yeah. It's been on my mind anyway since we watched Killers of the Flower Moon. I'm really glad that these Indigenous people's stories are being told. And I think ideally they would be told by them. But then I guess that hasn't been happening so much. So perhaps it needs the likes of a Taylor Sheridan or a Martin Scorsese to sort of open the door and prop it open for other people to come through and, you know... Yeah. I don't know. Like, it's a tough one, isn't it? Because they aren't their stories, but they've got a platform. So perhaps what they're doing is just good allyship. They're using their platform as white men to uplift important stories that need to be told.
Yeah.
But it's complicated.
Yeah, I think in an ideal world, everyone get to make their own kind of movies about whatever they wanted. Unfortunately, we are where we are. If Taylor Sheridan can get this movie made, then okay. Mm. It does seem like he spent a lot of time researching it. He kind of was relieved when he got some of the funding from Tunica Biloxi tribe because he kind of felt vindicated in a way.
Validated.
Yeah. It seems quite respectful of it.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that it is told from kind of Jeremy Renner's perspective is something that I was kind of toying with in my head and trying to think about. Is this okay? Do I think this is acceptable? And I did kind of hear him address that on the podcast, and he said, well, I am a white man.
Mm-hmm.
For me to tell it from a Native American's perspective would be incorrect because I do not have that perspective. And I thought, yeah, okay, you can't really argue with that.
I guess the only way around it would have perhaps been to bring on somebody from one of the tribes that were local to production to serve as some sort of consultant or advisor or even co-writer.
Maybe that was the case.
Yeah.
He did spend some time in somewhere. I don't know.
Everybody spends some time somewhere.
He spent some time somewhere. Yeah, no, but I think he did spend some time researching and with Native American communities.
Okay, good.
So I do kind of feel like it probably was a realistic take and got in as much information and contextual stuff in there as he possibly could. The other kind of one I thought about was the kind of the white savior thing. You've got Renner coming in with the gun and saving everybody. Again, we'll get to that scene. But I kind of thought about that as well, and I do have a kind of a justification in my mind.
Okay, I'm excited to hear that then, because I also made a note about that.
All right.
It's something else worth talking about for sure.
Well, that kind of involves one of the last scenes, so I don't know if we want to get to that.
Let's push it back.
Okie dokie. I think everyone in this is kind of at the top of their game. I think that Gil Birmingham is fantastic in Hell or High Water. One of my favourite things in that movie. And he's brilliant here as well. He has that really good scene with Corey.
At the end?
At the beginning of the movie.
Oh, okay.
There's another one at the end. We'll get there.
Okay.
but yeah, at the beginning of the movie where Corey turns up and they have a little chat, and that's, you know, Corey's describing about grief and how he's sort of dealing with his own loss. And you can really tell that he's not used to opening up so much, but he kind of accepts that he must do in that situation. And obviously Gil Birmingham is destroyed by all of this. And I just think he's just quite good and subtle in these scenes.
Yeah.
He doesn't get a lot of play. He doesn't get a lot of screen time, but he makes the most of it.
Yeah, I agree with that. He's so stoic that I found him really, really hard to read initially. And then you just get those little breakthrough moments where a flash of emotion comes across his face, and it's so painful and so subtle and so well done.
Yeah.
He's brilliant.
He is brilliant. And it is quite different to what he did in Hell or High Water as well. He was picked on, obviously, by Jeff. Jeff.
The other Jeff.
Bezos. Jeff.
Bridges.
Jeff Bridges. He was picked on by Jeff Bridges' character in that movie, but he was kind of quite lighthearted and sort of water off a duck's back to him. And
but also
he was quite
like,
charming and smiley. And
but a bit, you could tell he was a bit weary of it all. It's just like, for fuck's sake, this again.
He was definitely tired of it. But it was a completely different performance in this. And it needed to be because of the subject matter. You know, he's lost a daughter. He's lost a son to drugs, which is a kind of another contextual thing that is going on in this reservation.
One thing that I do really enjoy about Sheridan's scripts, well, particularly between this and Sicario anyway, he's one of the few writers who conjures up really, really meaty female characters.
Yes, obviously Emily Blunt in Sicario.
She's great.
Olsen in this. Yeah, I think Olsen's good in this. I think the character's pretty good. I would have liked to see more from the character, maybe.
I mean, but she doesn't get as much screen time as Renner.
It would compromise the kind of the tight running time of this.
Yeah.
I'm kind of okay with that. But she is an interesting character because she's not she's a little bit naive, but she is smart as well at the same time.
Yeah, she's completely out of her depth. I mean, obviously they're playing on the whole fish out of water trope. She arrives, is it from Las Vegas?
Yeah.
She's come straight from Las Vegas. She's really uninformed about what the case even consists of, what the place, the terrain, any of it. And that kind of feeds into her naivety, but then it sort of is peeled away to show a really fucking tough, determined young woman.
Yeah.
And I think it was necessary as well. In a crime like this, obviously trigger warnings abound. But crimes like this where it's a female victim and it's not just a death, it's a sexual assault as well. I think it's really important that they have that female character. I mean, important, but also maybe a little bit cliche, you could say. But I like that there was a female kind of determined on her behalf, kind of makes me wonder if a male counterpart would have been quite as keen to get to the bottom of it.
Well, obviously, Corey's character was there as well to help. He was sort of a tracker, I guess.
I mean, he's got his own reasoning because he's friends with the girl's father. He obviously lost a daughter as well.
Mm.
So he's got his own reasons for wanting to find the culprits.
But I think Olsen's, what I like about her character as well is that she is tough and smart, a little bit naive. To have a nice, well-rounded character, it's nice to see someone having the empathy, but also is capable, knows what she's doing, and kind of has the smarts to get the thing done that she needs to get done.
Yeah, I think it's funny because I wouldn't say we're like swimming in really good female characters these days, but the representation is so much better than it used to be.
Well,
and I know. But even like 10 years ago when people were kind of begging for quote unquote strong female characters, and then idiots online would just be like, there's loads. Look at like the Resident Evil films. That's not a character. That's a caricature.
But do you know what? I love it as well. People always go, well, you've got Sigourney Weaver. Fucking in the 80s.
Yeah.
That was 40 years ago.
Quite. The cliche became strong female characters, but they were without any nuance.
Yeah.
They became a stock character in themselves. Yeah. They were physically strong, physically capable, but that was all there was to them. Sigourney Weaver less so, because obviously she was a bit more well-rounded.
Oh, listen, she's a great
Ripley,
female.
Obviously not Sigourney herself.
Yeah.
She's great.
She's one of the greatest female action heroes of all time, like hands down. But
she likes cats.
Oh, she goes back for the cat. That's the one thing I can't understand about that movie. But yeah, she is one of the greatest, don't get me wrong. But that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's different movies. You want a different type of character as well. And in this, I do think you need someone that's a bit more well-rounded, because we are covering a very dark, disturbing subject matter. Mm-hmm. And I do think you need that kind of reflection in this movie.
Yeah, which is why I think her character is so well-written, because she's not necessarily got the physical strength of those, you know, in quotes, strong female characters that we just mentioned, but she's got grit.
Yeah.
And the smarts come into play, as you said, particularly that scene when they go to the house to find the girl's brother.
Yeah.
She's really smart, the way she kind of, she's barely able to see at that point because she's been maced, but she's still determined. She's still kind of keeping her distance, keeping an arm's length, rounding the corner in a really sensible way in order to keep herself safe. But also the end of the film, her final scene where she's kind of in the hospital, realizes the magnitude of what the female victim at the start went through and just bursts into tears. Mm-hmm. You can have both.
Yeah.
You should have both.
Yeah. And I say again, like, it depends on the movie that you're making, but this one definitely benefited from a more well-rounded character for sure. It's nice to have a female character that's compassionate, maybe does a little cry when it needs to happen, is smart and capable.
That isn't surrounded by male characters going, oh, she on her period.
Yeah. But no, I was going to say, it's also nice to have male characters that will also cry and be compassionate. And it's
human.
Real human beings. Yeah. And I say again, depends what movie you're, you know, if we're talking about fucking Driven with Sly, then you don't need those things.
I disagree. I think all movies could be improved.
I think some of the people in that cast did cry, but for very different reasons when they're reading the
script. Not when the cameras were rolling.
After they shouted at their agent for being cast in that movie. I love that movie.
You don't have to give a disclaimer every time you bring up Driven. We all know.
It's a good movie.
That and RoboCop. Yeah. It's all we hear about.
But yeah, I think she was really good in this. Would I like to have seen more from her? Yes, I would. But again, I don't want it to compromise the runtime. So
yeah,
maybe
you don't want it to run the risk of it like bloating the film.
Yeah. And there was quite a lot of stuff with Jeremy Renner's character that wasn't fully explored as well. Mm-hmm. Not that it needed to be, but there was stuff in there about his character and that fed into the wider narrative of the film as well.
Do you not think that was explored enough then?
I think that we're given enough and we get what we need from the performances.
Yeah.
So I do feel like we get enough because you see it on everyone's faces and the conversations that they're having.
I really enjoy that scene with the two of them actually in his house, perhaps at the midway point.
Is that when he's making bullets?
It's around that time. And they both kind of soften up a little bit. They both sort of start to drop their walls. And it's just a really nice moment and an interesting one for both characters. I liked that.
I think he opens up about his daughter
a
little bit there. And I don't think you really find out exactly what happened.
No.
You find out
we
she
don't
was
need
found.
To.
She was found. Her body was found, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you don't find out what actually happened. But you would assume that something similar.
Yeah.
That's my kind of how I read it.
Or some sort of accident. But we don't need to know because, I mean, if anything, that sort of hammers home the whole point being that we often don't hear about these things. We don't get to know.
Mm.
And also, it wouldn't ring true if every time he talked about his daughter, it was like, oh, you remember my daughter Emily who fill in the blanks.
Mm.
It wouldn't flow.
It wouldn't flow. And also, it does feed into the kind of the thing that they said at the end of the movie with the statistics and it not being reported. So
yeah.
You get enough to know just a little bit.
Reported or even investigated.
Yeah. But it fits that we don't really know anymore
for
multiple reasons. So I think that's actually quite smart.
And it doesn't harm his character arc at all.
No. And I think what I said earlier about there being a load of cuts of this movie, I think that I've heard him say he was quite brutal with the stuff that he cut. There was stuff that he really, really liked, but he decided on this cut that there's everything that you need.
So when you say there were 54 cuts, I'm really interested to hear more about
this.
You're
going to ask me the question that I don't know the answer to.
Always.
Yeah.
Always. No, when he says there are 54 cuts, is it that he whittled it down a little bit more every time?
I guess so. Maybe moved some things around or something. Yeah. I don't think there's literally 54 versions, like a director's cut.
Yeah.
A director's cut too. We're not doing a Blade Runner, Ridley Scott situation here. There's one with a narrator. Harrison Ford does the narration on one of them.
The Cabal cut.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't need that. No.
No, but I think so. I think probably just carved a little bit more out of this scene and that scene and because there's probably a lot of stuff that he really liked and it must be super difficult to, especially when you're a writer-director, you write what you like, you direct what you like.
And you're working with really talented performers.
Yeah, you're probably going to have some really strong scenes from the cast. And probably brutal as an actor as well. To be like, I really delivered on that scene. It didn't make the final cut. But if you don't need to for the story, then you don't need to. I do feel like way too often I complain about runtimes. But it's not really the runtimes that I'm complaining about. It's the economy of the story.
Yeah.
And I think that you can obviously tell a story in 2 hours and get everything you need to if you've got a smart script and if you've got good performances that tell you everything you need to know. But on, I can't think of another one now, but something that's 4 hours long
to Killers of the Flower Moon then, that's a good example. Did you feel like that could have been 2 hours?
No, I don't think that could have been 2 hours.
It was
such a vast story.
Like we delayed watching that by months because it was so intimidating. But actually when we sat down to watch it, I was engrossed.
I'd feel like a lot of that movie, it was really necessary information. It was really contextual stuff. It's a big, vast story that takes place over a few decades, didn't it, if I remember correctly?
Well, yeah, this is why I'm asking, basically. So it's all dependent on the specific project, I guess.
Exactly. But if you're doing a story like this and you can get everything you need from subtleties...
In under two hours,
that's kind of what you're... I feel like what the job of a director is to tell a story in kind of as quickly as possible so that you get as much information but not feel overloaded by it.
Mm-hmm.
I know nothing about writing or directing, but I feel like the movies that I enjoy most are ones that are just really economical with the information that they give you.
Yeah, you don't have to be in the industry to know a bloated superfluous exposition dump when you see one, you know? This, to me, is why I always say I don't necessarily think directors, apart from a few exceptions, should edit their own work. I think that should be a neutral party.
I think, judging how this one turned out, I know Sheridan didn't do the actual editing himself, mm-hmm. but he was looking over.
Yeah.
He was looking over old, who was it? He was looking over Gary's shoulder and definitely getting that down as much as possible. So yeah. I think I agree with you. I think on the whole, probably it should be a different person because they're not as close to it and they can be more objective about it.
And a bit more ruthless when they need to be.
A bit more ruthless. I think there are probably some director writers that probably should edit their own work. It depends on the case by case basis.
Yeah.
Who else we got in this? We've got John Bernthal. I forgot that he was in this.
Same. Hard same. He popped up in the third act and I was like, oh yeah, that guy.
Yeah. Pleased to see him. He's not in it an awful lot, but he is an important character and kind of a tragic one, really, because I don't know, if he's in a movie, I'm expecting him to be not a nice person. He's got that, his typecast is a bit of a git, isn't he?
He's got a bit of a boxer's face, so he looks a bit rough and tumble, I suppose.
But even in the MCU, he's a murderous...
Yeah.
Bellend.
I love The Punisher. How dare you?
Yeah, so do I. It's great. But he's the worst one.
Yeah.
He's the one he's not really a hero, is he? He's a murderer.
Yeah.
Maybe they all are to an extent.
Oh, for sure.
Separate
yeah.
conversation.
Yeah.
But yeah, I kind of expect him to be a bit of a bad dude. So when he turns out to be kind of a hero, I guess, he tries to save her. He doesn't. But he tries.
I wouldn't even call him a hero. He's just...
I couldn't think of a better word.
Yeah, I know. He's gentle.
But...
certainly in comparison to the people he's surrounded by.
Yeah.
Did you know that John Bernthal lost 4 toenails making this film?
Because of the cold?
I've no idea. No. I found some trivia that said he lost 4 toenails and it didn't expand on it.
Okay.
Now my brain is just filling in ever increasingly... ludicrous gaps.
That sounds made up to me.
Yeah.
Were they
too specific to not be true.
I don't know. You can make up some really specific liars. They're the best ones.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm wondering if the toenails were attached to him before he just carried around 4 toenails in his pocket.
And he just couldn't find them one day. Oh no.
Taylor.
I've lost my toenails.
Right, we're shutting this down. Everyone get on the floor. Yeah, cast is great. And as I said, I think I think the cast are all kind of peak.
Yeah.
Peak of whatever I've seen them in. I think it's probably the best that I've seen Olsen in. I've seen her in a few bits and pieces, mostly the MCU, and she's fine in there.
She's pretty underrated, I think.
Do you think so?
I do. What? Have you ever seen a film called Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene?
No.
It's pretty good, actually. It's about an ex-cult member who is kind of extricated from the cult and stays with her older sister. And I don't know, touches on a lot of things like deprogramming and that sort of thing. And it's very interesting, but she's really good in that.
That sounds good. That sounds up my street, actually.
It does, yeah. Probably, I'm quite surprised you haven't seen it.
Yeah, sounds like the you would need to be a strong actor to convey those sorts of scenes as well, the deprogramming stuff specifically.
But
yeah, interesting. Let's put that on the watch pile.
Okay.
Watch pile.
Will do. But she's been in more sort of smaller projects that just kind of fell by the wayside that nobody really talks about, like Very Good Girls with Dakota Fanning and I think Boyd Holbrook was in it.
Mm.
I'm not going to say it's amazing, but again, she's really good in it. A lot of smaller roles like that, but obviously she's most well known for Scarlet Witch.
Yeah.
Which is a shame. I really like what she did with the character after Age of Ultron. Once she abandoned the Russian accent.
After, was it Flashdance, her brother? What was he called? Flash Boy?
Quicksilver.
That's it.
Flashdance?
Quicksilver.
Jennifer Beals wasn't in it. But yeah, I think
I'm getting mixed up between Quicksilver in Days of Future Past and The Flash.
Oh, maybe.
He does his superpower to a song. For some reason, I'm thinking dance.
Okay.
I don't know. There was a whole thing going on. I'm sorry. Please continue.
Thank you for explaining your train of thought to me. But yeah, I think it's a shame as good as some of the material she did within the MCU was, I think it's a shame that that's the thing she's most well known for, because I think she is super underrated.
Yeah, she was pretty good in that. I didn't love WandaVision as a show, but she had some really good scenes in that.
Yeah.
But really good in this.
Yeah, yeah, really good.
So I guess we should probably address why this movie is in this season, right? Is this
why it's a neo-western?
Why is this movie a neo-western? And this is
western,
where we
but make it cold.
Yes, make it make it really cold. Make it so cold that John Bernthal loses four toenails. So it's a neo-western. So the reason for that is because it just is, all right? And we've just got to accept it.
No, no, I don't accept that. Justify it. Justify your choices. Now, go.
So it's undeniable. It's undeniable. As I said in the last episode in Logan, that there's one coming up that I might have a bit more trouble explaining.
Oh, is this it?
No, this is not it. No, this is really easy to explain. You've got Jeremy Renner. He's a tracker. He's literally tracking people like Caliban in Logan.
Very unsubtly killing the predators of the flock.
Yes, yes. Open plains, vast landscapes.
Yeah, check.
They form a posse. To try and find, figure out what happened to Natalie.
Mm-hmm.
The gang, the security people, that ultimately you find out who assaulted Natalie.
Mm-hmm.
They're a gang that kind of subverts the Western genre in a way, because they're the outlaw gang, but they're security guards.
Yeah.
So I quite enjoyed that. It's a gang of people. And also it kind of subverts the quiet kind of man with no name vigilante trope, because Corey has to open up about his grief. So it has that character, but it does something different with it.
And also he's got a name.
He's got a name. Corey, his name is.
Yeah.
Corey.
Corey.
Corey. Yeah, so they're my reasons for it as well. Jeremy Renner wears a cowboy hat.
Oh,
check. There's a horse in it. There's gunfights.
Say no more.
Yeah, it's a neo-Western. And it's all three of these movies, the Sicario, Hell or High Water, and this, neo-Westerns.
Did you say the American Frontier Trilogy?
Yeah, he refers to it as the Frontier Trilogy
right,
as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we've already talked about how talented of a script writer Taylor Sheridan is. Is there any dialogue that stood out to you specifically? Because he is very good at the dialogue, isn't he?
Is there anything that stuck out to you? Why do you ask that question?
Well, I asked that question because when we were watching it, the first scene with Jeremy Renner and Gil Birmingham, when obviously they're talking about their kind of mutual grief, you kind of had a point where you were like, I fucking love this scene.
Oh, well, I know what you mean.
I just wondered if there was any sort of specific dialogue that stood out to you, anything that made it one of your favourites.
I think it's, that scene's coming back to me now. So it's when Martin says to Jeremy Renner, what are you doing? Basically he says that, I go after predators, what do you think I'm doing? So Gil Birmingham says, get off my porch and go and do it then.
Yeah.
And I really love that scene, because it's like, why are we standing around talking about this? Mm. You've got to get out there and do it. And I think also I can sort of see that Corey's quite relieved at that, because he doesn't need to be here now. He's going to go out there and do what he can do. He doesn't need to be here opening up about grief and stuff anymore. He's done his bit. I really liked that scene. I don't know. It was very powerful to me.
There is quite a bit of powerful dialogue in this. I think one of my favourites was when they apprehend Natalie's brother.
Oh, Chip.
Chip.
Chip Hansen.
That's the one. Yeah. I forget the exact quotes, but I know Chip says, sometimes I get so mad, I want to fight the whole world. And then Corey, I'm paraphrasing because I can't remember his exact quote, but says something like, oh, I felt the same way, but I always figured the world would win, or something like that. I don't know. It's just like really kind of punch you in the gut dialogue.
It's very good philosophy as well. It's you can't change the world. It's easier to change yourself. It's kind of that.
I know we've mentioned it already, but I also really like a lot of the dialogue between Jane and Corey when they're at his house. And something that I think is so underseen, but that I appreciate a lot, is just friendships or relationships of any kind of the opposite sex, where there isn't some sort of sexual tension or forced sort of romance, and they were both just there to do a job. Similarly to Sicario and the female and male characters in that film as well. There's nothing I hate more than when they try and shoehorn in a romance element. And I think a lot of writers do it because they're like, well, if we do this, then women will come and see it as well. And we'll, you know, expand our audience. No, no. I'm here to tell you. I don't give a shit. I don't speak for all women. I just want to see well-written characters. Yeah. So that's something else that I really enjoyed about this.
It's just not necessary.
No. No, yeah, especially in a story about this. It would just cloud the wider issues.
Yeah, you don't want to have a kind of two people meet and they're no. kind of getting to know each other. It's like, no, it doesn't fit in this story at all. No. That's not the story that we're telling. And also it takes the focus away from the stuff that's important. I think that I would have really hated that. And I think I hate that in general, if it's kind of crowbarred in. Obviously you have your romance movies, that's what they're about, so that's fine. Mm-hmm. I probably ain't watching them, but that's fine. But there's something like this, you really want to just concentrate on the things that are important, and that wouldn't be it. Fucking, it makes me angry thinking that yeah. that might have happened. It would never have done, because he would never have allowed it.
No, but it's sad that it warrants bringing up. Yeah. That it's so rare that it stood out to me.
Yeah.
That's quite sad.
Yeah.
But yeah, that would not have served this story. Well, not only would it not have served this story, it would have really hamstrung it.
I think so. It just would have been okay, so how much time are we dedicating yeah. to this new romance now?
And it would have been 20 minutes too long. And it
would,
yeah.
You would either have been concentrating way too much on the romance element so you get to see their chemistry, or there would have been a kiss out of nowhere and you'd just go, what? Why is this happening?
Yeah.
So it would have been really jarring, or a different movie. And yeah, just that wasn't what this was. So glad that it wasn't even a consideration.
Yeah. We're getting to that point now where, once again, trigger warnings, we are going to have to talk about the penultimate scenes, the climax. Obviously, they figure out who the culprits are. They kind of surround
the trailer.
Yeah. And all hell breaks loose.
Yeah.
And as you say, there's that kind of cut and we are filled in on what happened. And it's one of my few, very, very, very few complaints about this film, actually, is that they show the rape. They don't linger on it. It's not, I was about to say it's not gratuitous. I think it's all gratuitous.
Do you? You think what this movie is gratuitous?
No.
The scene.
Any instance in a film where the rape is shown, I think it's generally gratuitous.
Okay.
And I say this as somebody who's a fan of, like, I Spit on Your Grave, so it doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense that that's my stance. I understand in a film like that, in, say, a rape revenge movie, some of that is necessary in order to put yourself in the woman's shoes, see what she goes through, and therefore justify the second half of the film, the revenge. Whereas in this, there is no revenge. There's just a woman who lost her life after being sexually assaulted. There's no relief. There's no catharsis. And I hate that. And I think it's one thing to acknowledge that it happened and that it does happen in real life. But I don't think we need to see it in order to understand the brutality of it. I think maybe just a cutaway, the implication of it, maybe some of the sounds that are associated with it. I don't think we need to see it. That's my only real complaint with this film.
Okay. They do show it. I think I hear what you're saying. Maybe it might have been better if there were just some close-ups of her face. And as you say, some of the sound design can maybe do a bit of the heavy lifting there.
They don't linger on it too much, which I'm grateful for.
I was just about to say, they don't linger on it too much. And I didn't give it a great deal of thought, but I hear what you're saying. And quite a simple fix as well. We're only talking about a couple of frames, really, to change. Maybe you can have the camera just shooting her face and a close-up and you understand what's going on.
Maybe there should have been a 55th cut of this film.
A 55th cut, yeah, okay. It is a scene that's really hard to watch, really difficult. I wonder if there's an argument where it's a fucking rape scene. It's difficult. Like, this is what the film's about. So,
well,
if you find that hard, then this is not a film for you, because we're talking about something very real here that happens.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, again, like I say, you don't necessarily need to see it to understand it.
True.
I think anybody with an ounce of empathy can sort of put themselves in the shoes of people who are victims of those sorts of crimes and realize how soul-crushing and violating and painful that must be. And like I say, I think the one sort of distinction for me is that in the rape revenge subgenre, which I'm a big fan of, the women do tend to get their own, they achieve their own catharsis because they get their revenge. And this was just gutting.
I see, because you saw that, you saw the assault, and you know that she, we already see right at the start of the movie, and the whole movie is about how her murder, is it a murder? It's not a murder technically, it's an assault that leads to a death.
Yeah, that's something they discuss in the film, because the guy at the morgue refuses to list it as a homicide.
Yeah.
Even though there's obviously foul play involved.
So because she didn't make it, she can't enact her own revenge on the perpetrators of the crime.
Which is true to life.
Yeah.
And really hard hitting, and a story that needs to be told. And obviously, unlike the rape revenge subgenre, which a lot of women who are survivors of sexual assault, obviously not all of them, but a lot of them do find solace in those kind of films, because it is wish fulfillment in a way. It makes them feel better to see somebody enact revenge against those sorts of people who commit those crimes. Yeah. Whereas in this, sadly, it's really true to life in that she dies.
Yeah.
She's violated, and then she dies despite having fucking fought and run 6 miles barefoot in the snow.
Yeah,
heartbreaking.
She makes it really far. Renner describes her as a warrior.
Yeah.
And yeah, she doesn't live, and she can't have any sort of revenge. But there, as a viewer, we do have some, we get some kind of justice. I get to see some sort of justice being acted, right? Because obviously, after the trailer part where we see it goes back and we see the assault, and then after that it goes back to present day, and that's when the gunfight happens.
Yeah.
Really, again, really good way of structuring that, I think.
And really emphasizes the brutality of the violence, because actually there isn't a great deal of violence throughout this film. And then it just sort of comes out of nowhere and really grabs you by the throat.
I think obviously you get shot at the beginning of the movie of Renner killing predators. So, you know, you have the brutality and the violence of, it's not really nature because he's taken him out with a sniper rifle, but you know what I'm kind of getting at. It's kind of the brutality and the violence is as a result of this place, this isolation, and the lack of law enforcement, and just the kind of situation that everyone's in.
But yeah, I do, as much as I enjoy this film, I do find it to be just a massive bummer. Like, it's a real downer, because there are, like, I know you've said there is some element of justice, but there are so many senseless deaths, many absolutely pointless deaths of people on both sides of the fence. And I don't know. Again, there's no real catharsis. And I'm not saying there should be, because this isn't that story. But yeah, it's really heavy, really, really heavy. Just because by the end of the film, all these people that we've spent time with, they've all lost someone or have died themselves.
Yeah.
And I hate to say it, but that's probably more realistic.
Yeah, it's a dark story. No one kind of gets out of this without some kind of battle scars or dead. Many people just die in this movie as well.
Yeah. Let's circle back around to that scene with Corey and Gil Birmingham. I can't remember his character's name.
Martin. Yeah, it's a really good scene.
Yeah.
He obviously paints his face, and he's going to kill himself, Martin. He's got a gun in his hand, and he kind of says, I've decided that, you know, now's the time, enough is enough. But he got a call from Chip, and he decides that he wants to live. But he'd already by that point sort of painted on what he refers to as his death face, I think. But it's very sad because he doesn't know if it's even the right thing that he's done.
It's really sort of that line of dialogue kind of killed me, because it really hammers home like the fact that these people have lost touch with their own customs due to colonization.
Yeah,
it's really sad.
But a short conversation, but it gives you so much.
Yeah,
and that's probably, if we're talking about dialogue earlier, that's one that's just really indicative of Sheridan's writing. I think is that it. There is so much there in kind of a lot of his dialogue that you can, it just gives you information to kind of grab onto and lets you know what kind of world that we're in.
Yeah.
And that's when he kind of is, I don't think he gives all of the details to Martin, but he kind of says, you know, job's done.
Yeah.
And what he's referring to there is that after Jane has had the firefight at the trailer with the gang of security guards, everyone died apart from Jane. one of the guards got away and Renner is sort of chasing him.
Arguably the most culpable.
Yeah, he was the one that started this whole situation, yeah. Wasn't he?
Oh, and his justification was that he was fucking bored. Oh my God, that character made me so mad.
Awful, awful. Yeah, it's really hard to watch to sort of see someone that's committed a crime that's so awful and treated someone so fucking terribly to justify it and go, well, there's been nothing else to do.
Yeah, just like Caesar as a thing, not even a person.
I personally found it very rewarding to watch that scene because Renner explains to him, I'm going to give you the same chance that you gave Natalie and essentially says you've got to run through the snow.
Which is no chance at all.
No, and he makes it not far at all compared to Natalie. And that was a really good way of comparing those two characters as well. Yeah. Very, very smart. And he was never going to make it out of this alive. Something that I thought about was... And it was linked to the perspective, the white saviour thing that we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, would it be better if Jeremy Renner's character was a Native American person? Would it be better if maybe his character and the Martin Gilberman's character was kind of the same person? And I thought about it and I thought, I don't think so. I think I like that it's a white guy that's done that. And this is my reason.
Okay.
I'd be interested if you've got a different opinion or if someone else has got a different opinion as
well.
Go
for it.
But my thinking is that Martin has already gone through enough. He's lost a daughter who's been murdered and assaulted, and he's lost a son to drugs. Now, do I want him to also have to live with the fact that he's also murdered someone?
Yeah, he's got enough on his conscience.
I know that the Hollywood kind of way is that someone hurts you and you go and take them all out and you gun them down. But like realistically...
Retaliation doesn't bring you peace.
Killing is still killing.
Yeah.
Like whether you kill someone that deserves it, quote unquote deserves it or doesn't deserve it, you've still got to live with the fact that you've taken a human life. So my thinking was that actually I quite like the fact that Renner's, he's already experienced severe loss. He's kind of not over it, but he's learned how to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we going to pile on Martin's character? We need him. He needs to be the best possible version of himself to try and help his son now. I'm really actually quite happy with that ending. I thought that it's right to me that the white man carries the burden of taking out the final bad guy.
Yeah.
And he's got to live with that. I quite like that. I don't know. What do you think?
I agree with that rationalization. Yeah. I think
it is a rationalization. Like I said, someone else might have a different point of view and I'll be happy to hear that.
No, I like that.
Mm.
Yeah. He's not the Punisher. He's got all of his toenails apart from anything.
Yeah. Punisher doesn't have his own toenails. You heard it here first.
So, Wind River.
Yeah. Good movie this, isn't it?
In summation, good movie, in it.
I think it's kind of impossible to talk about this without mentioning the other two, which we've mentioned 78 times.
Mm-hmm.
We spoke about Hell or High Water in season two in quite some detail. So it's been trying to be careful to not kind of cross the same.
Yeah, we don't want to be repetitive.
Yeah, exactly. But you have to in a way, and like not to compare them, but I think the three. They're so closely linked in terms of theme. They're all kind of about loss, the frontier, America. They're very American stories.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all of a piece in a way.
Yeah.
But I do think, the first time I saw this, I thought this is definitely my least favorite of the three, but I'm not so sure anymore. I don't think it's that clear. I think they're all really, really excellent movies.
Yeah, I will say on first viewing, I thought it was good. Mm. On second viewing, I liked it more, even though it is such a downer. It's not a film I could put on if I was in a delicate frame of mind, for example. Whereas Hell or High Water and Sicario, I could watch them no matter my mood.
Sicario is pretty dark.
It is, but it's great. They're all great.
Yeah, they are, yeah.
But yeah, I think this one is sort of in its own category on that basis, for me anyway. But yeah, I would have a hard job saying which was better and which was least favourite.
I think it's Hell or High Water is more my flavour because of the whole heisty thing going on there. And I really like
the Ben
Fosterness
of it all.
And Chris Pine, yeah, and Bridges and Gil. And,
yeah.
You know, there's, I think that movie's so good.
Mm-hmm.
But I really like Sicario and I really like this. And maybe it's Hell or High Water and then the other two that are just very close behind kind of thing.
The richness of character is just a big through line with all of them, though.
Yeah. I think he's very good at casting.
Mm.
You know, on paper, I might not have been that excited about Renner and Olsen being cast in this, but actually watching it, they fucking did it.
Yeah.
They delivered it. Everyone was really good in this.
That app is forgiven. Come back, Jeremy.
Yeah. Yeah, I tell you, when we saw Jeremy Renner on the snowplow at the beginning of the movie, I did get a bit nervous. He wouldn't get the insurance now, would he?
They wouldn't cover him.
Premiums would be too expensive. But I mean, he's not going to be wrong. Wind River 2, is he? Which there is going to be a Wind River 2.
Are you joking?
No.
Oh.
There's going to be a sequel to Wind River. And when I saw that a while ago, I think.
Okay.
Did you think, that's weird. You know, there was a Sicario 2.
Which was also pretty good.
Sicario 2 was pretty good, yeah. But yes, but this one's called Wind River Rising or Wind River The Next Chapter. Not quite sure yet what the title was going to be.
Okay.
It's marked as in production on IMDb.
Huh.
Principal photography has already happened between March and April 23. So I think it's in post-production by the sounds of it.
Oh, wow.
So it's kind of there. It's just with the editing. But because it's not out yet, I know there was the whole actors and writers strike thing.
Yeah, that's slowed
I wonder
everything
if,
down.
If there's maybe some pickups and maybe some reshoots that they need to do, which is why it's not been released yet. That's my guess anyway.
Do we have any idea of cast? Or?
Yeah, it's the characters, Chip Hansen.
Okay.
And Gil Birmingham.
Oh, brilliant.
I've done character, one character name, one actor name there for you, just to confuse things.
Martin and Chip,
yeah, they're going to be in it. Not sure how much Martin's going to be in it, but Chip apparently is going to sort of assume the Jeremy Renner role, kind of a tracker character.
So the focus might be more on the Indigenous characters this time.
Yeah, it seems that way. So it seems like the things that we were kind of questioning earlier, and just saying, you know, is this right and stuff? It sounds like that might not necessarily get addressed, but we might get a version where those stories are being told from Native American perspective instead of the Jeremy Renner perspective.
Promising.
But where did I get this from? From Wikipedia, I think. The FBI enlists the aid of Chip Hansen, a newly minted tracker for the US Fish and Game, to solve a series of ritualistic murders on a reservation he calls home. Now, the only thing that kind of made me a little bit nervous in that synopsis is the phrase ritualistic murders.
Okay.
I thought, are we going to go down a more kind of horror-y type route?
I hope not. And you won't hear me say that very often, but I hope not.
I think it depends how it's written. Taylor Sheridan's not involved in this at all. I think he would probably have some kind of say in it. I don't know. Given that he wrote and directed it, I assume that he owns the rights. So he would have to approve for anyone.
I have no idea.
It made me a little bit nervous, but you know, there's a scene in this where Jane is pepper sprayed and she's kind of blind and she's running through the house. That was kind of an homage to Silence of the Lambs, apparently, Jodie Foster can't see in the
Basement. Literally, one of my notes when we were watching this, Jane's character, my brain was just like, a bit of a Clarice Starling here.
Yeah.
How funny.
Totally intentional. But I think thinking about that, because they're trying to sort of solve murders in that one, and not necessarily ritualistic, but it is a horror thriller.
Mm-hmm.
Wind River is a thriller. And maybe if they introduce a bit more tension and a bit more horror into it, maybe.
We'll see.
Maybe. But
we'll see.
It's been funded again by...
Not the Weinsteins.
No, not the Weinsteins. The Weinsteins are going nowhere near it, I don't think. But definitely financed by Acacia Entertainment again.
Okay.
So it's the same Tunica Biloxi tribe that we spoke about earlier. So
awesome.
More of an Indigenous cast. Yeah, I think I'm actually quite excited for it now.
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to be watching it. Is it going to be as good as Wind River? Who knows? Maybe it'll be better. You never know.
I will reserve judgment.
Yeah. Me too. Yeah, so Wind River, done.
Yeah,
good movie.
I was nervous.
I was nervous about this one too. It's such a heavy, dark subject matter.
Yeah.
You want to treat it with respect, and I want to... It's just sometimes it's hard to articulate my thoughts when something is so so dark, you know, I have to tone down my knob gags and stuff like that. So yeah. That's, you know, kind of restrictive
in a way.
It's
a tough one to make funny, that's for sure.
Exactly, yeah. But it's not necessarily one that you want it to be funny. Mm. But I think it's such a good movie and I would be pleased to watch this again.
Yeah, and I think it's an important film as well in that it is kind of bringing some light to the absolute clusterfuck that is the justice system when it comes to Indigenous people. The fact that the lines are so murky about who they can and can't prosecute when it's on and off the reservation, whose jurisdiction it is, it's fucking madness.
Right.
And it's not good. It's not good, to say the least. And the fact that there are so many of these women who go missing, who are murdered, who are never seen again, and it's just either not investigated or even logged, their existence just kind of ceases to be important to the general population. And that is so, so sad.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I've seen more recently about, I know there's a Canadian organization called No More Stolen Sisters. So there is more light being shed on things like this, but it is the Indigenous people doing it. Mm. And I think it's important that it gets a wider audience to those issues.
Yeah, 100% agree. I'm very happy that this movie got made. It is one of those that I think maybe everyone should kind of watch this movie.
Yeah, but make sure you're in a solid frame of mind.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course. Definitely trigger warnings for this one.
Mm. What about next week?
So next week we're going to lighten the mood somewhat because we're going to do a Kevin Bacon classic. You've forgotten, haven't you? So we did Rock, Paper, Scissors, and we decided we were going to do Tremors.
Tremors, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's a neo-Western?
There's a lot of dust. I mean, you can't argue with the open plains of it all.
Yeah, I mean, tune in next week to hear me justify why it's a neo-Western.
And we'll talk in length about Graboids and Burt Gummer.